You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. I last week shared a story about my chomper.
Yeah. Bryant sent me some too.
Was it Bryant?
Oh. I knew Bryant Lane. Yeah, he gave me some too.
Okay. Yeah.
Did you get some?
He listened to the podcast. My note said, chew carefully. Nice podcast. Did you get ghost pepper?
I didn't get ghost pepper. I forgot what I got.
So we got a gift from Bryant Ling, beef jerky from Buc-ee's.
From Buc-ee's.
So he must have been somewhere where a Buc-ee's was.
Yeah, which is wild. That was like just last week.
Yeah.
Unless he, well, no, because mine came in a Buc-ee's grocery bag.
Yeah, how did that happen?
So he didn't have it shipped.
He wouldn't have listened to that episode till Friday. It's Monday now.
Maybe he just
Bryant
has
lives in the future.
What kind of sorcery
either,
is this?
Either Bryant lives in the future or he's got a Buc-ee's like in his garage or something. He's got his own
stockpile
Bryant
of Buc-ee's.
Bryant is Buc-ee's.
No. Bryant is Buc-ee's? How is your chomper?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, dude. So after we talked on Monday,
I can't stop looking at your teeth. That's all I look at now.
They're so weird. It's so weird. I went expecting them because I had to get new veneers and expecting them to just put my old tooth back on, my old veneer back on while they're getting the new veneers. But no, they had to completely like give me mouth surgery on Tuesday. It was horrible. It was so painful. And now I have these weird little nub teeth until my veneers come in.
I'm so glad you said that because they did look small and I was worried they were your new veneers.
Yeah,
I was like, they didn't do very good, man.
I think he put them there because he's worried that I'll like bite something and chip these teeth.
Oh. He's probably worried you're going to eat beef jerky again.
Yeah.
That would be my guess.
So, yeah, that was horrible. And I
keep us posted, though, on how the veneers go.
I have nub teeth.
It's a good little subplot.
18th.
Oh, boy. That's some time.
But I have a feeling when I get them, Kevin, it may cause you to stumble.
I think it will. When you get the new chopper, nothing gets me like a good smile.
My smile is going to glimmer. It's going to have one of those little ping.
Like in Home Alone.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Oh, I have a disturbing... Gosh. Would you rather question for you guys?
Oh, boy.
So excited.
Yeah.
And
just to clarify once again, Brandon does not let us in on these things. He just goes for it.
So I was actually talking to one of our staff members, and she was telling me about this horrible flight that has led to my question. And her flight, I just have to tell you real quick, and I've asked her permission if I could share this. So she was on a flight somewhere, I think maybe to Asia, back when she was in the corporate world. And
that narrows it down. Yeah,
she's sitting in the middle seat, which is already for a 15-hour flight. It's pretty rough. The person next to her is like keeps like he's typing, but he's like furiously typing with his chicken winging his elbow.
He's an elbow typer. Yeah. He's like like little chicken wings going off.
So keeps like bumping her, and then the guy to her right is sitting crisscross applesauce.
What
with.
No shoes on.
Shoes and socks off.
Oh, man.
And his feet, she said, his feet were on my pants.
Oh. Just getting warm for 15 hours. Like,
And then he would get up, go to the bathroom barefoot, come back, and put his feet on her pants.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't think you could pay me enough to go barefoot into an airplane bathroom, man.
They don't let you go barefoot at a climbing gym.
Let alone 30,000 feet in the air for 15 hours.
Oh.
That is rough. So the question is, let's say you're on a 15-hour flight.
I'm about to be.
If you have to sit next to someone who's doing that with their bare feet on your pants or has excruciatingly severe body odor, which one would you choose?
I think I choose no vacation.
You'd stay home?
I think I'd drive. I'd find a way to drive. No.
To Asia?
Man.
Driving to Thailand.
Has Elon already built his tunnel?
He figured it out. I think I go shoes. I think I take the sweaty foot.
Oh, man. I figured you for a foot.
A foot guy.
You're always letting your dogs hang out.
Well, here's the thing. I am pro flip-flop. Like, I wear flip-flops all the time. But on airplanes, I tend to not because I get it. Out of, like, common courtesy to others, I'll throw my shoes on. And even if I pop the shoe off, I'm for sure keeping the sock on. But even then, I don't think I pop the shoe off. That's awful. So I think I go that route just because I can at least, I think I could bring myself to ignore the foot. The scent is unrelenting. You can't ignore that. It's just there. Like, how do you churn your smell off? You know what I mean? You can't turn your smeller off. It's just the happening.
Your smeller?
My smeller.
My old smeller.
So I don't
know. Could you wear, like, my choice. You plug your nose or would you still taste it?
You can sniff hand sanitizer. Just like keep applying hand sanitizer.
Just sit with like your head in your hood, you know, like covering everything.
There are,
I don't know.
There have got to be a high number of people that are willing to pass gas on an airplane thinking that no one knows it's them or no one can smell it. And I don't know why they go there in their head because we're all breathing the same air.
Well, it's just recycled air. Though?
Uh-oh.
Nature calls. I don't know.
Rachel's one of those.
Chili beef. We've just learned.
That's the real reason I got the nickname.
Oh. Ew. I assume there's a filter on the recycled air, though.
Yeah.
Not that potent,
though. Yeah, but like you're sitting next to someone. What makes you think that an airplane has magic air?
Everything goes up.
Everything goes up. All right. So Kevin's a foot. Who would prefer feet
foot guy
on his...
Than to BO.
Yeah, how about you, Rach?
I couldn't do the touch of like someone's foot on my pants, especially knowing where they've walked.
Yeah.
What they walked on.
So you're taking the BO, though.
I would take the
15
BO.
Hours of BO. You're going to get off that plane and you're going to smell like
probably.
It. Because it will have covered you.
But I wouldn't have touched them.
But you've touched their scent.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Sometimes I
you're
think
wearing
about,
their scent.
Sometimes I think about like, yeah, like when you're smelling someone, you're actually smelling particles from them.
Yeah.
Like whatever you, was is in
it's
your
a part
nose
of them.
Was on their body at some point.
I don't like this conversation.
I always feel like if I get off an airplane that's longer than an hour long flight, I feel like I have to shower.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It just feels gross, right? Like, yeah. There's something about it that's just nasty.
The seats.
Everything.
The people.
Yeah. So many people will never listen to this podcast again after this conversation.
Use awful. Your free sanitary wipe.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, gosh.
This is why so I wish I had the kind of money where I could get those bed seats.
Bed seats. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because you have your own suite and you just like lay down.
Still the same air, though. You know what I mean? Still recycling that air.
Yeah, it's true.
It's just but now maybe... the person in coach is farting and you're hearing it. He's sitting on his next to you.
Maybe the solution is to get those free little sock things from business class or ask someone for them and then be like, hey, have you tried
these
socks?
Little socks?
They're wonderful.
Put these little sockies on. See, here's why I
you
choose
just
the
bring
foot.
A pair of brand new socks when you fly.
For whoever's next to you. Because hey, here's the thing. I personally don't think I would. But at least with the foot next to you, you can call it out. Like, there's the potential of them changing their behavior.
You think?
The guy with BO, man, you're just 15 hours from a shower. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
I feel like I could tuck a book between the shoe and my body. I could add a blanket. Like, there's things I could do.
That's true.
That I couldn't do to Mr. BO. Or Mrs.
Give,
Mrs.
Give
BO.
Deodorant.
You could, but does that solve it?
Just start spraying them.
just apply. Be like intentionally missing to like hit them.
Man, can you touch that button? Spray their armpit real quick.
While they're taking a nap.
So I'm wondering if you guys, given that Job is having all these conversations with friends, and I'm thinking about the part where he says, like, you guys are not helping at all. I was just thinking about like my experience with going to people, and I feel like, and I don't want to put down Christians here. Mm-hmm. This is not, that's not my point in this. I'm also a Christian. But I feel like it disproportionately when I go to when I have gone to Christians before for advice, there's this sense that they need to answer, and like they have like their, I don't know, they're just quick fix, they're quick solutions.
Cliches or, yeah.
What is that? Have you guys experienced that? Or what is that about? Like, why do you think that exists?
Yeah.
Or is it just me?
I kind of want to say it's just you, but I don't think it is. Yeah, there. I think this, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago, I think it was on the podcast, about the kind of propensity we have as Christians to put a shiny veneer, which is hearkening back to your teeth, but to put a nice veneer on things and to make it always look perfect or look good. And I think it stems from that, right? This idea that because we believe and know where the story's going, we think we always have to live from that place of like finished polish, right? Mm-hmm. Like out of that reality, which it is our hope, but the nature of hope, right, is that it doesn't currently exist. And so I think we have a hard time living in that tension of both holding the hope that we have and yet at the same time living in that tension in between. And I think that, well, I think that's part of it. I also just wonder if part of it is we aren't great at doing the hard work with people, of just sitting with people in their pain. Like
the messiness of it.
Yeah, we're uncomfortable with that, which I think is, I mean, that's in some ways fair, right? Like, I think we need to grow in that. We should be more and more comfortable. If of any people, we should be the people comfortable with the mess. Yeah. But we tend to want simple cliches, simple solutions to complex things. Mm. Yeah.
I wonder if sometimes it's even a fear of being wrong. Like, I think sometimes when I respond quickly to something, it's either because I think I know the answer or because I have an answer that I feel like works, or one that I've like had for a while. But if I don't have an answer or take too long to answer, it almost feels like it's not sufficient or helpful enough. Mm. But maybe it is that uncomfortability with not knowing or with being wrong, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned something that was pretty fascinating, Kevin, before we started recording, about the idea of happiness and how happiness plays into this
conversation. Yeah, I think that part of, you know, if we zoom out maybe further from even just Christians, part of the reason that Americans and maybe Western culture at large struggles with this idea of suffering is, you know, from our founding creed, right? We are, you know, promise life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so that is kind of the undergirding organizing principle of America, right? Is life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, all of which are good things. I mean, those are good, healthy things to have at the core of who we are. But downstream from that, their impact and import into how we're like formed and how our worldview is shaped is, again, this pursuit of happiness. Like, we center the idea of happiness as the sort of highest ideal, or maybe not even highest ideal. Maybe
I think it would be highest ideal.
But I think we almost assume it as a given, though, too. Hmm. Like, we, in the same way that, like, you know, that creed, life, liberty, those are guaranteed. That's what the Constitution states. We'll give you life and liberty. But what's interesting about the third is it's not that it's promised, but it's the pursuit of happiness, which is interesting because almost within the statement, it's saying happiness is elusive.
Yeah, you may not find it.
But we'll allow you to chase it. You know what I mean? And so there's almost like we've imported onto that the same promise of life and liberty and believe that it's the promise also of happiness. But
can
maybe
we assume it's like a byproduct of the two.
Well, and that was going to be a little bit of my question for you guys is, do you think happiness can actually be attained, or is it similar to, I know sometimes we talk about like wealth, like how much money is enough, right? It's that old Rockefeller line, a little bit more, you know, that was his answer to that question. How much money is enough? A little bit more. Mm-hmm. Is happiness in the same realm? Like, can you attain full happiness? Or is it always elusive? And then I think where I'm going with that is downstream, a culture organized around that. One of the byproducts of that, whether intentional or not, is suffering is always then viewed as an intrusion on happiness. Yeah. And so therefore it's always an interruption.
An impediment to the goal.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Opposed to a natural, a part of the human condition. Hmm. Like, and all of us, I think almost everyone would say, of course, suffering is part of the human condition. But again, when we get a little bit deeper and say, is that a belief that we actually live from? I think most of us, if we're honest, would say no. Like, we view happiness as the baseline, and therefore suffering is an intruder. But yet it is kind of part and parcel to being human.
Mm.
Does that make sense? Like, so I don't know how to wrestle with that.
Well, I wonder how much of happiness, or how much we associate happiness with comfort. Because even that piece of the discomfort of suffering.
Yeah.
Is it that it's the absence of happiness, or is it just that we've often associated times of being happy with when things are going well, or when they fit our mental maps, or they fit the things that we want?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're pretty good at chasing comfort, you know what I mean? And live in an area where we, for the most part, have the means to achieve, you know, or to dispel any discomfort. And so then when discomfort does come, it tends to be large.
Yeah.
Right? It's deeper suffering than just kind of plain discomfort. But
I always kind of feel like happiness is a little cheaper than contentedness.
Mm.
Mm.
Like, happiness is good and you're going to feel it sometimes, and sometimes you're going to feel sadness. Like, sometimes you need to feel sadness, and sometimes you need to feel a lot of other different emotions. But I feel like contentedness can exist across the spectrum.
Yeah.
And maybe when people say joy, like biblical joy, that may be closer to contentedness. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's kind of where I've landed with it, because I feel like pursuing happiness, I've been down that road.
Yeah.
And it generally yields, like, it generally yields a lack of contentedness. If happiness is what you're pursuing, you're always going to kind of miss it.
Yeah.
And and then you just kind of wander.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really important distinction. And like, I was thinking as you were sharing there, like, in some ways, do you find contentedness after being disappointed in happiness? You know what I mean? Like, can you arrive at being contented before you recognize that happiness is fleeting? And so it's almost like that's the next layer of maturity, right? Mm-hmm. Is realizing happiness isn't something that we can seek after and achieve. Mm. And so you learn then to grow in contentedness with your actual life, you know, the life you've actually been given, opposed to the idealized version somewhere out in the future that you're chasing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know
what it is? Yeah, tell me if this feels wrong to you guys. Happiness is kind of like a drug, and contentedness is more like being physically healthy. So like a drug, you're chasing, you're kind of always chasing that high.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm speaking of like illegal, illicit drugs that are really bad for you, not like Advil.
Caffeine.
Yeah.
You're always seeking it. It's always going to,
It
eventually you're going to need more of it. It's going to underdeliver, all that kind of stuff. That pursuit is restless, kind of, right?
Mm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Kevin always gets this look when I feel like I'm not making sense. Kevin just has a frown on his face, like, I really want you to win here, Brandon, but just not following
that
train.
I'm just disappointed in you.
The pastoral frown.
The pastoral frown. No, I think there is something to that. Like, contentedness is certainly, it's a healthier state to be, right, than the pursuit of happiness. But yeah, like, it's interesting. Even like right now as we're talking, I'm feeling a tension about speaking down about pursuing happiness. But maybe that's the Americanness in me, right? Again, of like, that, like, I don't, is it wrong to pursue happiness? Mm. It's a really interesting question. I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily wrong.
Yeah.
But that might contradict what I was just saying.
I wonder if we'd have a clearer picture of what it means to pursue happiness than contentedness. Like, I feel like happiness maybe has more of a formula. Or like, if you have these certain things, then you'll be happy.
Yeah.
But contentedness is almost like that lived experience. Like, I think that you said it goes a layer further.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which.
Wasn't happiness extrinsic?
extrinsic.
I have a speech impediment. Is that a word?
Extrinsic? Yeah. Outside of the self?
Yeah. Isn't happiness
opposed to intrinsic? Yeah. Yeah.
Something that you have to go find. And contentedness feels more internal.
It's certainly, like, I think, less circumstantial based. I mean, by its nature, it doesn't depend on circumstances, right?
Yeah.
Because that's almost how you transcend the circumstances, is by learning to be contented in all things. Mm. You know? So I think there is, like, an extrinsic. Now you got me screwing it up. Extrinsic part to
my little teeth nubs make S's hard to say.
I've been trying not to say it, man.
I almost have a lisp.
Yeah.
As someone, I also have veneers on my front two teeth, and
what?
I feel like
that's crazy. I don't have veneers.
It's like,
I feel so sad.
I don't know. At least to me, it's traumatic. But I don't know how you
traumatic.
Traumatic. Because the S's, I feel like people used to mention it for a while. They're like, did you realize you say your S's this way? I'm like, did you realize I can't help it?
Wait, you say that with your veneers?
Yeah.
So I feel like once I get my veneers, oh gosh, if I still can't say my S's right, that will really upset me.
Mine were potentially lower budget veneers.
That's the title for this episode.
Low budget veneers.
Low budget veneers.
It's a good album title, by the way, too.
I'm trying to imagine the circumstances in which you would get low-budget veneers.
Because they told me they were cosmetic, and I was like, please, look at my teeth. Like, there's no way that I could live with this. I've already lived with it for 10 years.
For 10
and
years.
Like, it's cosmetic. It's not necessary. Anyway, that's...
It's especially cosmetic now, because if they got removed... Oh, no, I mean, it's especially necessary now. Because if your veneers... Have you seen your little nubs before?
Yes.
They shave
smaller
your,
than fingernails.
They shave them down to nothing.
Oh, I know. We talked about it last week.
It's like, it really, honestly, it feels like a violation. You're like, you mutilated my body. Without these fake things, I have these two little nubs in my mouth.
I kind of want to call the podcast Little Nubbies. That kind of feels more appropriate.
Okay.
Oh,
so,
my gosh.
So he said, Dan actually started his message on Sunday by saying, this is a direct quote, I tried to write it down, that it's easy to come to the Bible and pick out bits and pieces of what we like, ignoring anything that makes us feel uncomfortable. Eventually, though, we create in our minds an image of God that is a reflection of our own preferences. Hmm. And then, yeah, he went on, you mentioned, Kevin, to say the Bible has a word for that, and it's called an idol.
Yeah.
Does that feel pretty true to you guys? Do you feel like that's something that we struggle with, or that you've struggled with at some point? Does anybody have a good story about that?
Yeah. I don't know if I would, like, well, maybe a story will come, but I'm just thinking about how this, the way in which we read scripture, like maybe this one I want to say, if reading scripture hasn't offended you in a while, I would suggest that this is what you're falling into, right? Like, if coming across God for who God is doesn't at times, like, disagree with you, I think there's a propensity we have to drift towards the parts of scripture that we're comfortable with or that we feel are tame, and then we tend to then reconstruct, as Dan said, all those little pieces into, this is who God is. And so how do we let God kind of, again, provoke us in ways to, like, come fresh again? Like, and that's, I don't know, for me, this preaching through this series has been such a reflection in that for me of, like, man, there are some really deep, uncomfortable questions that Job is asking, that I think even from stage a few times, I've been like, gosh, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is there. Mm. And I think that there's a healthiness to that, to try to wrestle with God for who God is opposed to who we've created him to be.
Yeah.
You know, but I think there certainly is a tendency for us to shrink God. And reconstruct him in our own image.
What about you, Rach?
I think that's why I love, like, being in the church so much, is that there are people who have experienced or think things differently from me, because it makes me realize how limited of a view of God I can have. Or even reading through the Old Testament, like, I usually read a lot more of the New Testament, but reading back through the Old Testament again, like, just praying that prayer for fresh eyes, because what I might see as, like, an unnecessary not unnecessary, but a long list of laws. Like even to hear other people talking or naming like God's grace or mercy in some of them. I think just hearing other people talk about God or the way that they've experienced him through the word or through their lives. It challenges my view of God, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Of like where I need it to be challenged more. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because if I start to think that I have like this right
have it all figured out
view of God, yeah, yeah, and then I'm not, I think what you said, like not made uncomfortable or challenged at all.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, who am I to tell God who he is?
Yeah. I wonder as a theology master, doctor almost. Yeah. How like looking at, certainly you had, you've had to at some point looked at like the traditions of faith and the split, yeah, of all the different denominations. And it makes me wonder, like from your vantage point, like how many of those like doctoral splits and like the, all, yeah, the different denominations, yeah, yeah, were formed just because someone was uncomfortable with a part, mm, of theology about God and decided, yeah, to distort scripture to make.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
yeah,
it was like a tough, ooh, thing to unravel.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, I would, certainly there's some of that in the church history. I think some of it is the genuine interpretive challenges of like, you know, two camps that love the Lord and are doing their due diligence still come to different conclusions. Like there's a complexity to that, that the word of God is without fault or error, mm, but our interpretation certainly isn't, yeah, right? And so there's certainly that as well, as well as I think, yeah, the uncomfortability to say, gosh, that cannot be true, and so therefore I make this sort of thing. Like I don't know, the more I think the more education I've taken on, like in a formal setting, I think to me it's been a journey of realizing more and more how much I don't know.
Yeah,
and there was certainly a season, particularly like when I was starting my master's degree, where it felt like, oh, I've got this thing figured out, and there was an arrogance that swelled up in me, for sure. But then, like once I pushed through that phase and realized, oh gosh, there is way more in the history and the tradition of the faith, mm, that I, one, know nothing about, and that's really humbling. And then also of just the encounter with people who hold different positions than me on different issues or whatnot, particularly like within Orthodoxy, that are like, yeah, but these people love Jesus too, and genuinely, mm-hmm, came with scripture, doing their due diligence in a different space. And so I think the hope is that it fosters in us, what I try to allow it to do is a genuine humility to say, like, it's the old dictum, like, you know, we hold, now I'm going to screw it up. It's, in essentials, unity, in non-essentials, liberty, in all things, love, right? I think that's a really important posture to hold, mm-hmm, that there are in fact essentials, and, mm-hmm, those tend for me to go back to the creeds. I think we talked about the Apostles' Creed a little while back of like that, that's an anchor point, that we hold to that with unity with other believers. That's where we really want to fight for unity. There's a litany of things that are non-essentials that we hold with much grace and liberty. And then in all of that, we have to have a posture of charity or of love, to say that, yeah, we're really humble, finite creatures trying to navigate what it means to know an infinite God. And we should probably hold those things loosely and not believe that we've arrived at some sort of, like, yeah, we've got it figured out. Man, yeah, that just feels like a masterclass in arrogance that we should avoid.
Isn't that, there's kind of like a big, an overarching theme in Job where that's sort of like the sentiment, right?
Playing
like,
out, yeah.
There's so much more to God than you understand.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, the complexity, the nuance of both God, of the world, of sin, of, mm-hmm, suffering, human condition, the role, I mean, all of that is spoken to in a way in Job that I think is just, it's, again, I feel like I say this every series we do, but maybe it's because I'm coming awake more and more to it, but like the just sheer sophistication of, mm, the biblical authors is, I mean, Job is a masterpiece of literature, like let alone a divinely inspired word of God. Like there's that piece, of course, but like we forget just how masterful this book is put together. Mm-hmm. And it's because we just don't necessarily in the modern world have an appetite for that kind of reading. Like I've been challenged by, I heard Tim Mackey once say one of the best things he ever did for studying the Bible was learn to read good literature. He's like, cause that's in some ways the genre that the scriptures are written in. Mm. And so we're used to Twitter and we're used to Netflix and we're used to, you know, all these kind of simpler modes of entertainment, which aren't bad, but they don't train you to read classic literature. Mm. And so like, I've been trying more and more to read the classic novels and stuff, which I'm really not great at, but just as a way of fine tuning that muscle. Mm. And Job's one of those. There's all sorts of nuance, all sorts of little comments that shape the trajectory of how we read the book. Mm. That we just have to pick up on, mm. you know?
Well, I wonder how that even shapes the way that we approach the text. Like, I feel like sometimes I can approach other novels with maybe more imagination or like mm. more room for yeah. the characters or the plot to take shape. But sometimes with the Bible, until it comes to maybe more challenging passages.
Yeah.
For some reason, I come in with a totally different approach.
Yeah.
But there is room for yeah. imagination or like for our imagination to be mm-hmm. expanded or our mm-hmm. view of God to be expanded.
Yeah. Yeah. We tend to, I think, approach the Bible with a like, a hard literalism, you know, that again, it's just history recording one thing after another. And that's such a modern Western way to view history. Yeah. You know, the example I tend to give is if like we were to ask someone about September 11th in the modern world, we'd tend to go with like, well, on September 11th at 7:02 PM or AM, this plane hit this tower on this floor. And we use all these little like details, which isn't bad. It's just, again, that's the way in an information age that our minds have been wired to process events. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a more Eastern ancient way of history, they tell stories. They tell how, you know, they don't say how the watch works. They talk about time and, you know, like in those sorts of things, like they use more elaborate metaphor to get at the same thing, but not a like rote literal one event after the next event. There's some of that within the scriptures where there's, you know, history being recounted that way. But there's other ways that are just, again, this is poetry. Mm-hmm. And poetry, you don't read literally, because that's not what poetry is supposed to do. It's not how it functions as a thing. And so you have to approach it, I think, differently. And I think, Rachel, you're right. Like, we tend to approach a blanket view of scripture from that lens of harsh literalism. Instead of reading it literarily, like with respect yeah. to its genre.
So Job, he gets mad at God. He starts kind of firing yeah. back at God. And my question for you is that, like, when we think about how we approach God, is that like a sin? Is that
yeah.
okay? Is it,
yeah.
is it okay to yeah, come at
yeah, yeah.
God when you're
yeah
upset at him?
The biblical writers seem to think it's okay, don't they? You know what I mean? Both in Job. And then again, if you read the Psalms, like yeah. there's often a shaking of the fist at the heavens. Like, and so, yeah, I wonder, it's a good question. And I wonder if sin is the right category to place on the question though. Mm. Like I think there certainly can be sinful ways in which we speak to God or about God, but in this vein, it feels like, I don't know if God's up, you know, if God's sitting there thinking, ah, now he crossed the line, that's sin. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's relational. And in a relational mode, there are ways in which we speak to someone we're in relationship with that is free and mm-hmm. with some liberty. But there's also times when it crosses the line, you know? And so I don't know quite how to like navigate that tension other than, again, to filter it through the metaphors of marriage or close friends or kids. Where there is like a sense with like with my girls where I would want them to be able to rage when they're mm-hmm. angry. There's probably a moment where it's too much, right? And I don't mm-hmm. know quite what that is. But really what I'm interested there is not so much to keep them within the bounds, but how do we reconcile through that, right? Yeah. Like there's a healthiness to them still wanting to come and rage right. towards me. Like that's a good, healthy
There's
thing.
There's a connectedness in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think obviously where that metaphor breaks down is I am not God. And so I don't always respond in the way I should, whereas God does, right? God does respond in the way that a loving father would. And so that's maybe the counterbalance to it. Mm. But I personally, just to answer more directly, your really good question is I don't think it's necessarily sinful. I think there's a lot of health in being able to communicate your raw emotion to God in a way that does just pour out what's actually like. It's when the facade finally drops, and we don't have to play games with God anymore. We can just be. And I think there's a real health to being able to just be with God in that sense. And Job gets there. I mean, he's demanding essentially that God makes his case, like, this is unjust, and so fix it. Why is it unjust? Like, let's hear your side of it. And I think Job is actually convinced he's right. And is actually thinking he's
pretty bold.
Caught God. Yeah. I think, and that's an interpretive move, but
if
I think that's
blameless
what Job
and
is.
Upright before.
Yeah.
He just lost it. And in that case, one of his friends is a little bit right.
Yeah.
Because wasn't his friend kind of saying, like, you're making yourself guilty.
Surely
with
you did something.
Mouth.
Yeah. And that's where the friend Elihu, which we'll see this week, that's his critique against Job. All the other friends actually kind of manufacture sins that Job has done. Elihu is the first that actually identifies Job's self-righteousness. And he says, you're essentially being too self-righteous here. And the way he's speaking about his innocence is actually arrogant unto itself. It's exactly what you just picked up on. And I think, I need to go look this up, but I believe God actually affirms Elihu's accusation of Job's self-righteousness. So I think he does eventually, I think it's in chapter 40, where God does say essentially that you've gone too far, if that makes sense. So there is wherever that line is. But
Dan, can you imagine if you were in an argument and God said you were right in your argument? That'd be the ultimate trump.
Yeah. But what is your guys' experience with, like, again, that sort of honest reflection to God? Like, how do you guys process that question? I think it's a good one. Yeah.
I feel like if we weren't able to share honestly with God, then to me it would feel like a false sense of intimacy versus an intimacy that's been, I don't know if tested is the word that I want to use, because it's not that we're testing God, but one that's like been fostered and maybe even like challenged, but deepened through that. Because I think the times where I have either cried out to God or questioned or wrestled with something, I think that initially it didn't bring me closer to him, but I feel like there is a closeness that comes with that freedom of being able to bring those before him and know that it's not too much for him, or I'm not too much for him, or that it's not something that can't be moved past.
Yeah.
I think it's so common to live life. I'll speak for myself. It's so common for me to live life apart from God. To make decisions and go about my day on my own with my own plan and my own agenda, that when if I get to a point where I get worked up enough and emotional enough and my heart is invested enough in something that I bring it to God, I have always found that intimate act, because there is, like you said, there's an intimacy to bringing your, I'm not talking about like abusive anger, to bringing like a really intense heart cry to somebody. That's an intimate thing. And I have always found, almost, I think maybe every single time I've done that with God, it feels like he's drawing me closer.
I was thinking through, you know, I shared a couple of weeks ago just that it's been a tough year for me personally, and navigating some just like some really dark areas. And it was interesting that I think part of the propensity we talked about earlier of like always projecting a front or always having things good or whatnot, like that had been my default mode in my prayer time with God too, where like I couldn't allow myself to have that sort of honest freedom. And interesting, like there, it finally got to the point where, and this was through kind of talking with some friends and a therapist and those sorts of things of helping me navigate some of those and allowing some of those emotions to come to the surface, where I remember one time distinctly in my prayer time where all of a sudden I cussed at God and like at him, like not about him, like at him, you know? And like, it was and it was so interesting, because it was literally the first time I'd ever done that.
Yeah.
But it was like this sort of liberating, like, oh, I just hit raw emotion in a way I hadn't. And I had covered that up. And I think there was still me wrestling with trying to be authentic. And so I don't think it was like an intentional clean myself up before God, but it was, I hadn't got to that space of like freedom before God. Mm. But I think to exactly your point, Brandon, of like, there's an intimacy that came from that. Now, would I necessarily like prescribe someone to do it? I don't know. Like,
listen, go and swear.
Yeah, just go swear at God. But there's something to the freedom to realize like, yeah, at some point you do have to get though to that real level of honesty, and find that God's still there in that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a beauty, there's a freedom in that to realize I can bring all that ugliness of what I'm wrestling through. Mm-hmm. And God's still in that mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about Kelly's story that Dan shared. And just the sort of the rawness of it. And I think about, you know, her, she was not able to walk, right?
And I then, think that's what it was, yeah.
And arms, then he started losing the feeling in an arm after all of that. And it just, like, if you're ascribing all of that to God, especially if the retribution, you know, theory is in play, man, it just feels so messed up and vindictive. And even if God just allows it, to have someone try to wrestle through their life with that disability, wrestle with constant chronic pain, which I know that many in our body experience too. What do you do when you have something like that and then you go and try to talk about God's justice?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, how do you rationalize
square those things? Those two things. Yeah. 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 It's hard. And that's one of the big questions that Job is asking is what is, it's in some ways asking like how in control is God? How meticulous is he with that control? What's the role of free will? What's the role of evil? Like, these are all the questions that are kind of swirling beneath the surface that are really important questions because, you know, I think it, and there is a version of which we can kind of view circumstances through God pulling all these levers behind the scenes. But I think that also carries latent within it where that view goes off track is, again, the agency that we have as humans, the free will that we have, which then reaps all sorts of brokenness, right? Again, this is the story of the scriptures, but specifically again, Genesis 1-3, right? God in his sovereignty gives sovereignty to the humans. And in that act, he creates space for creativity. He creates the opportunity for people to for humans to co-create the world with him. Like, that's part of our task is we are building a world with God. It also creates the opportunity and the ability to love because love, you have to have the choice to not love, right? Yeah. Like, all of that is in the mix here. And so downstream from that then comes the fallout of sin and it comes the fallout of brokenness. And so when then humans take their sovereignty and choose not to rule in the direction and in the image of God, but to be the arbiters of right and wrong, we are flawed. And so therefore we make decisions that are more selfish or individually based or whatnot. And the downstream effect of that, it just multiplies one on top of the other. That's where I think a couple weeks ago we talked about the idea of chaos theory, right? That like one decision reaps an infinite amount of ripple effects that we couldn't really ever foresee from that one event. I think it's that old parable. We might've used this before, but like when a butterfly flaps its wings on this side of the world, it swells up into a tsunami on the other side, right? Like that's the idea is the ripple effects are so vast and that's ultimately what evil is, right? It's the ripple effect from some action here that is spiraling in such a way that you just can't even imagine. And if you pay again, I reference this a lot, but if you pay attention to the first 12 chapters of Genesis, you see that one, that sin take place. And then along the way, before the Tower of Babel, you get this other guy, Lamech. I think it's like in chapters 5-7, somewhere in there. And Lamech is then, well, you see Cain and Abel on the way, and then you get a descendant of Cain and Abel, which is Lamech. And he's like raving about how, you know, Cain killed Abel, but I've done that 7 times over. Like, and you're watching the spiral of sin go from one act to brothers killing each other, to Lamech, who's raving about how powerful he is, to then the Tower of Babel, which is this full-on systemic evil that's trying to become like God, right? Like, we are the gods, we'll reach the gods. And so you just see this spiral and a view that kind of sees God as orchestrating all of it is one that I think fails to hold a high view of sin and its mm-hmm. impact.
Yeah.
And the depth of depravity and brokenness and the way that spirals into way more than just conscious choice. It is conscious choice. There is conscious individual sin, but that's the source of all that is broken in the world. Somewhere, some way, something like, you know, take global warming or something like that. There's an impact, whatever you want to say, it's all human control or not. Like, there's still the contribution of something like pollution that is built on systems that we can't even fathom to unravel. But the reality is those are rooted in things that are broken in this world. And again, that isn't a statement on, you know, whatever political side you want to take on it. It's just the fact that, again, our actions have spiral effects. And so all of that that is broken is culminating in all sorts of this devastation that we experience, whether it's a cancer diagnosis or natural disaster or broken relationships or childhood trauma or generational sin. Like, all of that is attributed to this monster of sin, that is, again, that tohu vavohu, right? Like, it's the chaos of the world that's unleashed on it. And God is in the process of unraveling that. And that's where I think there's, you know, Job is saying, don't you run this world off justice. But a cursory look at the world realizes, man, the rain falls on the just and the unjust.
Yeah.
On the righteous and the unrighteous. And there's simply, like, we can't rule with these simplistic views.
Yeah.
But it takes an infinitely wise God to navigate all that. And yeah, it's complex. It's complex, and simple solutions, which we want to have, we want to give, will never suffice. Will never suffice.
He said that one of the big aha moments, and we'll close with this, from Kelly, was that every time something went wrong with her health, that she heard a lie, and the lie was, God, you don't love me.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious what you would say, either of you would say to someone maybe who is in that, in the throes of whatever suffering they might be in the midst of. And maybe they are believing a lie that maybe it's not that, maybe it's something similar, but it's bringing them to a place where it's challenging their view of God, and they're starting to believe maybe that God doesn't care, doesn't love, that maybe he's not good. What would you say to that person, knowing that there are no simple answers?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'd start with, I'm sorry, you know, like, and just, I think a lot of empathy of, like, man, this life is hard. And at times life is terrible. And so I think I'd acknowledge that. I'd spend a lot of time acknowledging the brokenness of, like, yeah, that, it isn't the way things are supposed to be. I think at one point I'd hopefully turn and just say, and hang on. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even think I certainly wouldn't promise that it's going to be better. I wouldn't promise I don't even think I'd promise that it has a plan. Like, I think that is unhelpful, and I don't even know if it's necessarily true. I think chaos of evil is just a thing. There's a plan in the cosmic sense that God is in fact redeeming all of creation and moving towards new creation. But the path between here and there is far more nuanced and complex. And I'm not always sure that it's clear what God's doing in all of those things, other than he's working against the powers and principalities and putting them in their place. So in that, I think the encouragement would be, hang on. And I think we're with you. Like, it'd be a little more sharing, gosh, I haven't experienced that pain, whatever it is they're going through, but man, I've experienced the edge of life that sucks. And we're with you in that. You know, I think that's a little bit of what I'd point to.
Would you even go so far as to say God is suffering with them too?
Yeah, I would, for sure. I think that's one of the most important pieces of, again, like a theology of the crucified Messiah. Yes, he's resurrected, but he was crucified, and we can, I don't know if we downplay it, but we forget to look so deeply at that part of it to say like, we man, directly he had Easter. Suffered. Yeah, exactly. Which is the case for Good Friday and the case really for Holy Saturday too, of a silent day in which God was dead and buried and was just dead and buried.
Yeah.
You know? And that's why we need seasons like Lent to remind ourselves that there is a dark side to this world, and God is working it out towards that, but it doesn't make your pain and suffering go away right away.
Yeah.
But maybe it helps to know God's in it with you.
I feel like, yeah, just sitting in it and yeah, first acknowledging just that it stinks that you're sorry. And I think someone was sharing this in a meeting before, but they were asked the question of where do you think or where do you see God in the midst of this, or in the pain, and like, how would you imagine like encountering him in that? And I don't even know if that's always going to lend itself towards an answer of I see God with me in it or suffering with me. But I feel like sometimes even just asking that question as a reminder that he's not absent in it.
And maybe on one last really practical example, man, just spend some time in the Psalms. Mm. I've like the past 2 years, I've just been in the Psalms over and over, and it has breathed like so much life into my own prayer life with the Lord. And I think that links back to, again, a season of pain that I feel like I've been in for some time. And at times, you know, similar to Rachel, what you were saying, like, a lot of times I didn't have words to pray. And so reading the Psalms and just praying the Psalms back to God has been at times rich, other times the only thing I could bring. And that's been really helpful. But I think the Psalms are the life source, I think, of the people of God, because it just helps give vocabulary and freedom when we don't have it. So anyway, that'd be the real practical example, would be just start reading the Psalms, just pray, you know, if you read 5 a day, you'll get through it in a month. And just sit in them.
It is interesting that those are often more metaphorical rather than the literal easy phrases. Yeah. Like it's like hungering and thirsting for God in a land that's dry without water.
Yeah.
It's like sometimes you can't put into words what you're feeling, and it's not always the most literal, but
yeah, there's a depth to it. But you need that.
It's accessible in those moments.
Yeah. Yeah. Like sometimes words don't suffice, and you need to take your sock and your shoe off and just put your foot on somebody.
You just got to put your foot on someone. You just got to feel it.
Just help them
in your
feel
toes.
Better.
You have to feel it. Yeah.
Let
you have to
hold their soak toes. Into their clothes.
You just got to breathe in their odor deeply. The aroma of suffering.